catching to it, and Tiny Fran standing in the yard boo-hooing the whole damn time. Even after all was said and done and Roland was locked up, Tiny Fran still went around saying modern society had to take some of the blame for what happened to him. Burr said she'd picked that talk up from Roland's lawyer, and he thought about as much of it as I did. Why couldn't somebody just as easily said he was mean? Mean to the core, and then drove pure crazy with his mama all the time twisting what he was needing up with what she was needing, and then something clicked in that car and he let what was stove up come flying out. And as for what was on his mind when it clicked, I'd put my last dollar on it being Tiny Fran. You don't have to be a smart town somebody to figure that out.
When it rains, it pours. Sometimes things happen and they pile up on you so fast you don't know if you'll ever settle back down, catch up again. All yesterday, all I did was think, and then I waited for Jack, waited for him twice to come home and spell me from all my thoughts. Then when he came in and we rested and ate, it seemed like the whole day started over. I had to wind back down again. I stay tired enough now as it is. Somebody knocked on the front door about 8. Nobody ever comes to the front besides encyclopedia salesmen, Jehovah Witnesses, or lay witness missionaries from down at Ephesus Free Will Baptist, and I thought to myself, which one is it tonight and how can we get rid of him? And we couldn't pretend to be gone, not with all the lights on and Jack's game show blaring. He got up and peeked out of the front window and said, "Hot damn, Ruby, it's Cecil Spangler and he's got his Bible with him." I told him to have fun and that I'd be at the kitchen table cutting out June's skirt, but he wasn't listening to me. He was too busy thinking up what sort of game he wanted to play with Cecil. See, Jack had rather worry and agitate Cecil Spangler than eat when he's hungry. Whenever he sees him at the store or the stockyard or somewhere, he always comes back home and runs back through how he chased Cecil round and round on some religious issue, like the virgin birth or the seven-day creation, and how Cecil wound up on the short end, embarrassed in front of a whole gang of men, them no doubt egging Jack on. And as many times as Jack's come in the door saying, "I ran into old Saint Cecil today," you'd think he would hide when he sees Jack coming. But there he was at our door last night asking for it. Sometimes you have to wonder if he doesn't enjoy being persecuted, thrive on it. And last night wouldn't have been different from any of those other times if Cecil had just not mentioned my illness. But he did, and what used to be a way for Jack to show off how sharp and quick he is turned mean and malicious, and my husband is not a mean man. Last night drained him. I hope it's nothing we'll ever go through again. Maybe the next time Cecil gets the urge to pray over poor old Ruby, he'll do it from a distance. He'd be crazy to come here and try it again. While I'm on all this, I know it would make perfectly good sense for me to reach out to some religion now. People prepare to meet their Maker every day. But see, I don't believe I had a Maker. I don't believe anybody did, not Jack, not even Cecil Spangler. It's just not the way Jack and I think things are organized, if you can call everything that goes on organization. We just rather stay amazed at how it all happens. I mean, this world bumping right along with no plan at all. I'm not exactly sure where I've gotten everything I think about this, certainly not from the way I was raised. I guess I've just been making things up along the way and accumulating what did me good, throwing out ideas that didn't. And I bet you that's not a far cry from the way this world works. Thinking about dying, I'm not half as worried or depressed over it as I bet Cecil would be if he were in my shoes, thinking he's bound to be headed one way, and then having that doubt come in, you know it's bound to, and nip at all that confidence. What I mostly feel is a sadness over knowing I won't be physically here again, here in my house at my table with Jack. But Cecil and I do see eye to eye on one thing. Leaving here is nowhere near the end. See, I believe that when I die, my spirit and my body, tired and worn as it'll be, will separate, slip apart, and my spirit will live and see all and know all it couldn't before. and it won't matter what becomes of the body. The spirit can and will go and do as it can and will. I get more comfort out of believing my parents and grandparents are with me that way, rather than that they're somewhere I can't get to until I'm dead, when I won't need to feel them the way I've needed to lately. But back on last night, Cecil came in, settled in, and I heard him say, "Where's the wife?" I had a mouthful of pins, and before I could get them out, Jack answered for me. I stuck my head out of the kitchen door and waved at him. Then Jack asked Cecil what sort of burden he had weighing on his heart. He said, "Seems like you've always got some burden or other weighing on you. Just spit it out." Cecil said, "Well, I do. I've come here tonight with a heavy, heavy heart. You see, we down at Ephesus know what a terrible time you and Ruby must be going through, her finding out what she did and all. And the preacher and the whole membership just wanted me to come down here tonight and try once again to extend the right hand of Christian fellowship and let you know that it's never too late to accept the Lord Jesus Christ as your personal Savior." He got every last bit of that out, and I don't believe I heard him take a breath. And at first, what he said about me finding out what I did didn't hit me. But then I realized he was talking about the cancer, and I could almost feel something shooting straight through me. I listened for Jack to come back at that, but he was quiet, I know planning exactly how much rope he intended to give Cecil. Then he said, "Oh, you did you? Well, then why don't you just go right ahead? See, you've got to kind of sweeten the pot a little bit if you expect me to let my wife jump in it." Didn't Cecil think this was a little odd? I guess not. He just said he'd be more than willing to share the good news, and he started with the "In My Father's House There Are Many Mansions" psalm. I thought, of all the poems in that Bible, surely you could have found a less depressing one. But when he'd finished, Jack said, "You read real good." Then I thought, well, Ruby, at least you can laugh. Cecil thanked Jack, not offended at all, and then proceeded to explain the verse, going all into the streets of silver and gold, eternal jubilation, and so forth. All Jack said was, "That sounds just too good to be true." I had to get those pins out of my mouth before I swallowed one laughing. Then Cecil said the damned had an awful destiny, none of the specially prepared mansions and whatnot. And Jack told him he'd like to hear all he had on hell, seeing as how he'd been told to go there so much. Cecil jumped right in Jack's trap and told him, "Hell is worse than anything you could ever imagine. There's no place like hell." Cecil went on and on about all the screaming agony, suckling babies being torn from their mothers, all that torture at thousands and thousands of degrees, even down to whores and whoremongers grinding and sliding all over each other, men with men and women with women, sordid and repulsive, and all of it very unnatural. Then I heard Jack yell out, "I know, I read all about it." And Cecil told him he was glad he'd struck a chord, how everything he'd been talking about was all there in black and white in the greatest book ever written. Jack yelled out, "Yes, it has done rung a bell. And you're not lying about it being the good book. We wore it out at the store looking at it. Cover came off." He kept on and on about how much he enjoyed it and how glad he was that Cecil had read the same thing. And then he told him he'd been under the impression that the story had taken place in Paris, France, not hell. And he said that fellow did the ungodliest things with a whole room full of folks. I couldn't stand just listening, not seeing this, so I got up and stood in the kitchen door. Neither one of them noticed me. Poor Cecil was about to explode. He whacked that Bible on his leg and yelled out, "You cannot blaspheme the Holy Word. You cannot make a mockery of God's Word." Jack played dumb and told him, "Well, I was just trying to show you how you're not the only one with good reading taste." Then Cecil said, "All I came here to do tonight was to show you how the Word might lead you, save you from your sins." He said God's Word was the message of salvation, and he thought that might offer us some hope in these last hours. I was absolutely appalled. Jack changed. All that sarcasm came right to the surface, and he said, "I'll tell you something. They say the meek will inherit the earth, but I think you and the whole freewheeling Baptist bunch of you will be caught a day late and a dollar short, because a meek man wouldn't have had the gall to come down here tonight knowing about Ruby, and that's none of your business anyway. And I'll tell you another thing. I know the word, and the word is leave. Get the hell out of my house before I get my pistol out. Cecil'd seen me in the door by then. It looked like the same thing that shot through me earlier was now going through him, and he said, "Ruby, I'm sorry as I can be if anybody misunderstood me." I told him it was between Jack and him, but I did think the best thing would be for him to leave right then. And then Jack hopped right in and said, "Misunderstood, misundertook is more like it. Now get the hell out of my house." And Cecil did. He left without another word. Jack looked like he'd lost the war, not won it. Shaky, red-faced. I told him to come in the kitchen and I'd fix him a bowl of ice cream or something. But he said he had something to take care of outside first. I knew where he was going, and it's so seldom he takes a drink with me sick that I just let him go. He came on back in when I was about asleep, and he crawled in the bed beside me, all his clothes still on. I know he was afraid he'd fall down undressing in the dark. I backed up into him and let him hold me, and I could smell his breath just as sweet and thick as it could be. Then he kissed my hair and said, "Night-night, Ruby, see you in the morning." Oh, Cecil and all his heaven talk, he just doesn't know. I have what I need back there stirring now, about to call out any second and ask me if I saved him any coffee.
I'm finally at the point, past the point, where I can say this and mean it and not have to worry over somebody saying to eat my hat. I'm sick of being by myself. Sick of myself. Sick all the way around of looking around and not seeing a damn thing but the four walls and my old ugly self looking back out of dirty, smeared-up mirrors. Ruby'd be ashamed. This place looks like the pig slept in it, and I walk around all day looking like the witches rode me all night, raggedy, messy. I know it, but I haven't been able to do anything about it. You just can't expect a man to take and do without a woman when he's done with one long as I did. Be 2 weeks ago tomorrow I finished all Ruby's food. I looked down in that deep freeze all raw, cold, and empty and said, "What are you gonna do now?" I told Burr about it, and he told me, he said, "I told you you ought to have let me help you get some bean rows in, at least a hill or two." Then he told me I could walk across the field and take a meal with him whenever I wanted to, but I turned him down. I want to eat in my own damn house. So I started out on cornflakes, and when I got sick of cornflakes, I opened a can of soup, damn old watery-tasting soup. It won't long before I said, "Not only are you going to rot here, you're going to starve, too." Come along about Thursday, I said, "It's bound to be more than one way to skin this cat." Ruby used to say you just always had to believe you'd find as many answers as it was questions. And I had three big questions every day I needed an answer to. What's for breakfast? What's for lunch? What's for supper? To hell with the snacks. Then I was talking to Burr, and he said, "What you need is to get you somebody in there to help you out." I told him he might be right. I could get used to having somebody to wait on me. Burr told me he had something in mind. I said, "Well, what?" And he just said, "Come on, get in the truck, and let's take a ride." So I did. He said he was taking me out to the old Butler place. Said it might still be one or two working-age women left out there who wouldn't mind picking up a dollar or two. He said most of the tenants that farmed for the old lady Butler had about all moved to town when the old lady died, and they brought in all the big machinery and whatnot. But he heard a few hung on. So we rode on out there, and I and Burr both looked at the home place and just had to shake our head. Used to be that place was something to see. Big, big old white house. I remember riding by there on the way to the tobacco market one time, sitting in back in case the tarp wanted to fly off, and I remember seeing her out in front of the house standing over a colored man while he painted the bird bath. I just had to wonder what it'd be like if I'd been born a rich somebody with money. But it's not so fine a place now. Weeds up in the yard high as my hip, and that bird bath busted, laying on the ground. The whole business just gone to pure ruination. Bird told me when we were out there, he said one time he had to go see the old lady about some hay, and he got up in the yard, and damned if she didn't have a whole row of colored women lined up all the way down one side of the house cleaning the windows. One woman on a window, inside and out. And I bet you not a window on that house has been touched since she died. I told Burr, I said, mine's about that filthy. And he told me just to hang on, he'd find me some help. He said if it didn't work out, he'd send June back to my house this weekend to give it a good going through. I said I hated to ask June to have to come back in and mess in my mess, but you get in this shape and you can't be too choicy. Anyway, I and Burr drove all back through the old lady's yard, all past the equipment shelters, past the irrigation pond, about dried up, and then coming around the curve, I saw a big dried-out field full of houses, old people, old cars. This is exactly what it was like. It was like somebody took a notion to decorate the place and said, here, here's some houses, and pitched some little shacks out over the field. Then he said, here, have some people, and threw out a handful or two of people the way you sling corn over chickens. We pulled up in front of one of the houses, and the screen door opened, and the biggest, cold, blackest woman I'd ever seen stepped out. She came right over to my side of the truck, walking without bending her knees, more waddling than walking. Bird told me her name was Mavis Washington, and she'd helped him barn tobacco a few times. He said she was a card. Then listen, she said, how you doing, Mr. Stanley? Who y'all looking for? Bird told her I was looking for some housekeeping help, and did she know anybody who wanted to work? She laughed and fanned herself with both her hands, and she said, it ain't nobody likes to, but we all does it. Then she reached in her bosom, listen now, right in front of two white men, she reached down in her bosom and started pulling out this white rag, something looking like a baby diaper, and she kept on pulling like it was a magic trick. Then when it was all out, she wiped her face and neck all around and ran the rag up one arm. I thought, good God. While she was swabbing herself, Burr said, well, what do you think? Think you might could help us? Then she crammed that rag back down there, and without even looking up from her business, she said, what do you pay? I told her $10 a day, 3 days a week, a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, plus all the meals. Then she leaned her head back the way they do when they have the spirit, and she said, Lord, if y'all ain't something, I reckon if I fixin' to cook it, I fixin' to eat it, too. Burr laughed, but I wondered what to do. See, when he asked if she might could help us, I thought she'd take it like, can you help us find somebody besides yourself? But she took it the opposite and hired herself before I could think straight. A big woman pulling out of her bosom will throw you off. Then I thought to myself, I bet that woman can make biscuits the kind you dream of. So I went on and told her she could start work soon as she is able, next day if she could, early. She asked me if I'd carry her back and forth or should her boys. I told her her boys. So she got there the next morning. Not early, I'd already had my cereal. I stood there at the front door and waited for her, and I looked around my house and thought, I have a mess. A good woman comes to clean wants a mess, must crave a man's mess. I held open the door, and in she comes up the steps, not bending those knees, like she's wood. She grabbed the door and said, my knees is killing me. It must be gwine rain. She went on in and put this big old satchel down on the kitchen table and proceeded to take out all grades of mess and lay it all out over the table. She said, I likes to be able to get to my business. Then here comes her business out of the bag. It was first a sack of hard Christmas candy, then orange jelly slices. She looked at me, slid both of them across the table, and said to me, I likes to have something sweets to suck on. You welcome to it. I told her no thank you, and then she took out two all-stretched-out-looking ace bandages, lotion, two snuff cans, a white Bible, a big wad of rags like I told you about, two tall grape drinks, and a round donut pillow. About that last thing, she laid it on the table and said, "This is for when I sits." I stood there fairly well amazed. Then she picked up her old stretched-out bandages and said, "I gots to wrap these knees fo' I starts to pullin' and stoopin', they all swole up." Her legs, whew, looked like they'd pure blow up if you put a pin to 'em, big around as my whole head. I told her to go on back to the bathroom, and she went on back, and directly I heard something sounded like the whole toilet stool was tearing off the wall. I took and went back there and got by the door and hollered, "What are you doing? Be careful with my toilet stool." She said she's just doing her business and to go on. She finally came out, but she still had the bandages in her hand. She said to me, "You got a wobbly toilet. I can't rap on no wobbly toilet." I told her it didn't wobble 10 minutes ago. Then she just said again, "You got you a wobbly toilet." And she proceeded to sit down in Ruby's chair. I could just see the whole thing buckle. Look what she did to the toilet. So I told her to find somewhere else to park it. She went over to my big old stuffed chair I sit and watch the television in. It's real low to the floor, and before she is halfway down, I said, "You get down, you won't get back up." Last thing a man needs is a big woman stuck in his television chair. So she looked around for somewhere she could sit and not break or get swallowed in, and I wanted to say, "It must be a whole lot of trouble being as large as you are. Can't even sit down regular." Then she spotted Ruby's kitchen stool with the back to it, and she said, "That looks just right." It was nigh about noon when she finally got her knees fixed and all that mess on the table in order. I figured I'd leave for a while. I figured she might not want to clean with me in the house. Ruby used to take the broom and act like she is sweeping me out the door. So I went on and helped Burr fix his transmission, and then I went on back. I walked in the kitchen and said to myself, "Lord God, everything was just like I'd left it. Dishes strung out hither to yon, grease and mess caked on the stove. And you want to know where Mavis was? She was sitting on a couch with her head slung all back, like if I didn't think she was alive, I'd have thought she was dead, holding onto the broom like she was paddling a boat." I poked her on the arm and told her to wake up. She liked to jump 50 feet. Then she rubbed her eyes and told me, she said, "I went to sweeping and my knees just give out on me, sleeping when I supposed to be sweeping." Then she laughed and laughed, wiping her eyes, and she told me, "Whoo, Mavis do love to laugh. I finish it the next time." I thought, what? I told her she is so sore she shouldn't hire herself out, and she ought to look around that she wouldn't see any signs up saying I hire the handicap. She said my mouth was as bad as she'd heard it was, and then she laughed some more and got herself up off the couch. As soon as she put Ruby's broom up, she looked at the kitchen clock and said, "Whoo, Lord, I need to call Nathan to get me." And I thought, oh, shit. Then she asked me, she said, "Where's the telephone?" I told her I didn't have one. I'd let it go a few months ago. And the closest one was Burr's house right across the field. I pointed out the window. She said, "My knees is already give out. I can't do no walking." I thought to myself, I bet if the nearest telephone was at the honey bun factory, you'd run over me getting out the door. But I didn't feel like getting her started back up. I just wanted to go home. So I went on to Burr's and used his phone and said for Nathan to come carry his mama home. The next time she got here about the same time, late, and strode all her mess out over the table again. I told her, I said, "Mavis, I've got to go help Burr out over yonder, and when I get back, I expect to see something done, like the dishes washed, the floor swept, and so forth and so on." And I said for her to watch herself with the toilet stool. She won't half listening to me, bent way over, sticking her grape drinks in the refrigerator. She just said, "Somebody needs to do something about this nasty icebox." I just thought, Lord God, and I wonder who. Burr liked to have laughed his head off when I told him all about Mavis. I said, you pay somebody $10 to cook and clean, and then you eat chicken soup out of the last clean bowl. You pay somebody all that money and see how hard you laugh. He said he didn't mean to laugh, but it was still funny. That afternoon, I went on back across the field, and I got closer and closer, and I saw some clothes on the line. Then I got closer and saw it was my work shirts and dungarees. Then I got right near up on the yard and said, what's it doing with spots on them? She'd bleached my clothes. I wanted to jerk a knot in her. I went in the door and yelled at her. I said, what's it doing with spots on my dungarees? You don't bleach dungarees. And listen to what she said to me. She said, I got mixed up. I said, what? And she just said, I got mixed up, I'm telling you. And then she started back on what she was doing, which was opening one of her grape drinks between her knees. I thought to myself, those knees won't hold you to mop, but they'll hold a grape drink. Then she took her drink in the living room and eased down on her donut pillow and started shaking her head. I followed her in there and asked what was going on, and she said to me, I sure wish you had a telephone. All I could say was for her to give me the damn number again, and I went on and called her boy. I told Burr about it, and when he got through laughing, he said he'd send June out here next weekend. Nathan came and got her, and I told her it wasn't any need for her to come anymore, and I gave her $20 plus five more for gas her boy used hauling her. I went on back in the house and said, well, I wiped my hands of that, and I took and got my wrench and fixed my toilet. See, it had sounded like the perfect setup to me. Didn't it you? Isn't it every man's dream that when his wife dies, he has somebody to step in and do for him? I guess Ruby was right on the mark when she used to catch me sending off for something about how to make $1 million and say to me, if something sounds too good to be true, it usually is. Give me the envelope, save that stamp to mail a bill with. I listened to her then. I'd listen to her now. I just wish it was somebody here like her now that could tell me what to do.
Jack hasn't said much to me today. I've sewn all day. A little while ago, he came and stood beside me with his hands in his pockets and asked me what I was doing. I said, well, Jack, I'm sewing. He's so preoccupied with last night. I told him he should walk over to Burr's, that I didn't need him for anything until supper. But he won't leave here today. I also told him we could go sit outside when I finished this skirt. It's warm for November. I told June I'd have her things ready by Saturday. I hope everything fits, hangs right. I'd hate for her to go off on a trip looking homemade. Nothing looks worse. Jack can't think of a thing to do, so the television goes on. Maybe he'll fall asleep in front of it. He needs to either be distracted or asleep. Last night's just eating at him. Suppose he hadn't been here. Would Cecil have talked to me by myself? I don't think so. I've always believed that Cecil and most everybody out here are a little afraid of me. They always seem to speak to me through Jack. Like, Jack, how'd you and Ruby like your trip to the mountains? And I'm standing right there. They think it's odd, I know they do. They think it's peculiar as it can be, me married to him. Nobody's understood or tried to, except Burr and June and my family. I used to feel the urge to justify us to everybody who stared, but then it passed. Mama and Daddy were the only people I felt like I needed to explain anything to, and I finally did, but before I got to talking about Jack, I had so many other things to cover. They sat and listened. So did Sooty B. Jack was out looking at the farm with Paul and Jimmy. We'd agreed that I should talk to Mama and Daddy by myself a while. When I finished, Mama said, well, I guess you've about done it all. Who'd have thought you could do it all without leaving the South? And then later that day I heard Sooty B in the pantry with Lester. filling him in on everything I'd said, and she told him, "Shame the law don't allow Miss Ruby to marry her daddy. All she be wanting is to marry her daddy." I did want somebody to take care of me. I needed it. And when I felt all that goodness coming from Jack, it didn't matter what the person looked like that sent it out to me. Maybe I did want a daddy, but that's okay, too. I never heard any bells ringing and so forth, but look what happened to me when I did. The quiet kind of love is better than the other, lasted longer, been better to us. Oh, it's no crime to want and need somebody to love and to be loved by, and to go and do what you need to do to have it, but it's certainly a pity when you want it so badly you'll let it be anybody. And I certainly went from good to bad to good mighty quick. And now the bad's coming again, and it'll get worse and worse. And Jack will have to be here with me and see me, and he'll have to say, "Look what's become of this woman I married." If I'd knelt down with Cecil, maybe I'd be looking forward to good again, but I couldn't do that. I'll just wish and try to make it so for Jack. My brothers have promised to check on him, and I made Burr promise me the day after I was diagnosed to do anything he could here, June 2. And when I finish the skirt for her, I'll go out to the freezer and look at everything and try to feel better. I'm counting on that working. And then I'll come back in and see if Jack's ready to go outside with me. And we'll sit out there together until it's too late to see the pine trees across the field.
I washed my sheets for the first time in 2 months this morning. First time since June was here and stripped the bed down. They're white, needed some bleach, but it won't a drop left on account of Mavis going wild with it. I'm going to dye my dungarees back blue. Know why I took and washed my sheets this morning? I did it for Ruby. It was Ruby that told me to do it. In a way, it was Ruby. See, last night I was laid in bed sleeping, just sleeping regular, and then I went to roll over and I couldn't. What it was like it was somebody laying next to me on top of the covers. I thought it might be one of the dogs got in the house and crawled up in with me, but then I said it'd take Lassie to undo a lock and get in here. I went to turn again, and I still couldn't. Then I thought I might have been just mixed up the first time. You know how it is when you wake up like that and think you're doing something like getting some water, and then you don't know if you did or you didn't. Then I said, this is how Ruby used to do. How she used to lay on top of the covers when she'd get hot in the night. I'd have to wake her up and tell her I couldn't sleep with her weighting the sheet down, keeping me from turning. And last night, when I felt that same feeling, I was pure scared to turn my head around and check her spot. Can't you imagine? I laid there still as I could, and the next thing I knew, I was asleep again. First thing I did this morning was I got up and looked at her spot real close, looking for a dent like a body'd leave. I didn't see one, but I said, that don't mean she won't hear. Then I said, a spirit don't have weight. But if it was Ruby and she wanted to be here with me a while, she could take weight. She could do anything she wants to, nothing stopping her. See, every night I've laid in bed and wished Ruby was over there sleeping, laying on top of the covers, reading with the lights on, sitting up, eating yogurt, just everything she used to do. I've wished so hard you could call it begging. And I thought, of all the things I've wished for and I've not got, I've finally come through with this one. I and Ruby watched all the Topper movies we used to joke about hating all the time, and last night I bet she was missing me like I was missing her. Missing her all the night she'd scramble around in and out of the covers, and I'd say, Ruby, how about decide if you're hot or cold? And she'd go to sleep with one leg in and one leg out because she said she couldn't make up her mind. But I was just real touched by her coming, and what I had planned to do is woo her into coming tonight. I know you can't catch a haint and hold it forever. But don't you know I would if I could? Don't you know some you would? Before I put the clean sheets back on, I plan to sprinkle some of Ruby's smelly good powders over the mattress, shake some down in the pillowcase. All her woman's stuff, still on her bureau. I haven't moved anything. I don't know what I'd do with any of it. And it's not mine to be given away or thrown out. I'd rather let Burr come in here after I'm gone and decide what'll become of our business. But I'll fix a room up for her. I figure why would a woman, be she dead or otherwise, want to crawl in a musty bed with the sheets gray? I'm tempted to lay down with my two-tones on. Ruby did ever more love me in a nice pair of shoes. I'll wear the pajamas I got for Christmas a few years ago still in the plastic, and I'll act normal, like I'm not expecting anything but a good night's sleep in my new pajamas and clean bed. I sure don't need to look like I'm on the lookout for any irregular company, and maybe, just maybe, if I look enough like I'm minding my own business, she'll come in again and slip in beside me. I don't know what I'll do then. I wouldn't want to scare her off. What do you think of the odds? They say good things will happen when you least expect it, and what goes around comes around and so forth. I just hope that's so. But if something happens and she doesn't show up, it won't be the end of the world. She's been here once, I'm sure. And I'll tell you, having your dead wife haunt you can really tip your day off to a fine start. Outside, I got the sheets flapping in the wind, I had the coffee turn out this morning, and I got a free sample of Gargle in the mailbox. I think about all I've got left to do is fix up for her and say, Ruby Pitt Woodrow Stokes, come on down. Every minute Jack slept that night, he was awake for two. Every branch scraping the roof was Ruby descending. Every dog scrambling underneath the porch was Ruby rising. Only when he woke up at daylight and released himself from his damp, tangled sheets did he realize that his own body had fooled his heart the night before, just as trees and dogs had caused him to lie and wait. And sleeping and awake, he had dreamt of Ruby. He needed relief from his night, but holding her pillow and crying as he'd done other nights would not help him. His frustration and anger had rooted in and taken hold well below the place where tears start, and so would not be washed up nor out by them. His pain was the sort that burrows in and tortures until the source of the struggle is understood, reconciled, and removed. So little to you, foolish old man, you invent something, then get mad when what you thought was so ain't so. Woke up wound around a thousand nights. Pull the sheet out from the foot of the bed and it'll wind around you. Then wake up one night and call it Ruby. Me laying on the sheet and calling for Ruby. No fool like a goddamn old fool. It's what I get for wanting something. All I want me now is a drink of liquor. Wanting to take a drink. Goddamn room smelling like babies. Damn dusting powder in the sheets. Air it out then. Stood up by hate. What I mean to tell you, and not even stood up by one reel. He got out of bed and opened a window. The view to Burr's house was obscured by a lush thickness of flowering trees. He didn't see June's car there, or June on the porch with her father, hearing about Mavis, laughing some, then remembering Ruby. June said, I wish she'd been my mother. I wish she hadn't died. He left the window open and walked outside to the pony shelter to retrieve his liquor bottle. Today would be the first time since he married Ruby that there would be a bottle in the house. King, I'm my goddamn castle now. By God, somebody passing by sees my pajamas, let him look. Take a picture, it'll last longer. He was glad he'd worn his shoes. Dew was still on the grass. He thought how the shoes would have made Ruby laugh. You do tickle me, Jack. Always up to something. He stopped in the yard and looked at the woods across the field. He didn't want to think about her anymore. Her leaving, her not coming back. Especially her leaving. You laying there in the pink dress June bought. My insides, they yelled out, no. God, you were a beautiful woman to me. And when we put you in the ground, I told Mama to accept you next to her. You were a good woman, never meant anybody any harm. Neither one, just ways different, that's all. And Bird told me my Mama and my Daddy and this earth would accept you because your grace was something no one could turn away. And I cried then, Ruby. I cried all the way home. June told her father that when she finished cleaning Jack's house, she'd like to go back into town and buy some things for supper and they could eat together. Something Jack would like, June said, the way Ruby would have made it. She showed me how to make the dough, and we sat at the table, rolled it out, and cut it into long strips. Then she held me over the pot and let me drop them in. Couldn't tell Mama. She had enough evidence against Ruby. Jack came back inside, paused in the kitchen, wondering if he should rinse a glass, but he decided to drink from the bottle. Matched his mood. Then he pushed the bottle into the waist of his pajama pants, went into the living room, unplugged the television, draped the cord over his shoulder, and began slowly and carefully wheeling the cart down the hall as one would wheel a patient into surgery. Drink me a little liquor. Watch the cartoons. Watch 'em all day if I goddamn feel like it. That's a cure. Nobody to stop me. Yes, it's a plenty of ways to stay out from under a woman. Stay drunk. Stay in front of the television. Neither way you don't think, don't feel nothing. These goddamn sheets got to go. Shoes, too. Silliness. He stopped the cart beside the foot of the bed. But before he plugged it in, he stripped the bed, took off his shoes, put the sheets in the bottom of the closet, and dropped his shoes in on top of them. Then he plugged in the television, flipped channels until he found a very busy, bright cartoon, set the liquor bottle on the nightstand, and made himself comfortable on the mattress. He reached over for the bottle, unscrewed the cap, took the longest pull he could stand. Ah, goddamn. Won't take long like that. Look, Coyote'll drop an atom bomb on that roadrunner, then that little fool pops up and goes beep beep. He admired the roadrunner's resiliency, and after its next escapade, he had another long drink, then another. His distractions were working, but not quickly enough. Thoughts of Ruby, full and boundless as they were, would not be displaced by the colors, sounds, fresh air, or drunkenness he had brought into her room, and that frustrated him. What do I have to do? He didn't hear Burr's car outside, nor the car door slamming, nor Burr knocking at the back door. June told him to go on in, Jack might be napping. They went into the kitchen. June walked straight to the pantry, got out Ruby's apron and tied it around her waist and collected the dirty dishes into the sink. Burr called out, Jack, you decent? I got June with me. June smiled at that and ran the sink full of soapy water. Oh, shit. Me and this licorice powder-smelling mess. Burl think I lost my mind. What am I supposed to do? He's bound to come in and got June with him. Jack decided to feign sleep. So with the television still going and the uncapped bottle on the nightstand, Jack rolled over on his side, facing Ruby's place, and started to snore. Burr followed the cartoon sounds down the hall, knowing something was wrong and feeling it would be up to him to face and fix whatever he was walking into. He should have met us at the door, Burr thought. The television goes in the living room. Something's bad wrong. He pushed open the door and saw the scene Jack had set for himself. Heard him snoring over a commercial jingle. He turned the television off and closed the window. Flies were getting in the room. He's bound to be drunk, Burr thought. Picked up that bottle for him, just got it for him yesterday. The liquor that was meant to relax Jack was now making him nauseous. What am I going to say? He maintained his rhythmic snoring, counting off the beats, while Burr noticed everything that was strange and out of place about the room, especially the odor. He walked over to the bed, shook Jack's shoulder. Wake up! You drunk? What's going on in here? Jack decided to act nonchalant as long as it worked. Then he'd decide what to do next. So he rolled over onto his back, yawned, rubbed his eyes, and acted very surprised to see he had company. What are you doing here? I told you I was bringing June this weekend. What's going on? Burr measured his tone. Jack Stokes on the defensive was no good. Impossible to handle. I just wanted to lay up a while. Jack fluffed the pillows, arranged them, and sat up against them, wishing he'd thought to slide the bottle under the bed. Sit down and take a load off. Yeah, I forgot about June coming. I hate she had to walk in on a mess in there. Looks like the mess is back here. Burr sat down on the edge of the bed. Why are the sheets piled in the closet, he thought. To be sure he didn't mess himself up, no, to be sure not. Well, I just haven't gotten around to doing anything. Jack squirmed against the pillows. Except drinking half a pint of bourbon. Well, that's it, he thought. That'll piss him off, sure enough. Now you'll never get a straight answer. Smart ass. How many times did I take you under that pony shelter with me and let you take a drink when Tiny Fran was giving you hell? I'd say, pour some of this on them bitch bites. Out loud, Jack said, you got something against somebody drinking in his own house? Act like you never seen me take a drink. I've never known you two in the house. Well, he can get it as good as Cecil got it come missing. Everybody ought to leave me alone. Jack felt himself ready to say things he neither meant nor believed. Well, I guess you don't know me too good, do you? He said. It's not a matter of knowing you or not knowing you. I just know it's not something you'd ordinarily do. Burr hoped that sounded firm but inoffensive. He needed the truth so he could help. He didn't want to be lied to. Jack didn't know how to reply and not have the conversation continue its circle around the truth he was hiding. This ain't an ordinary day, so you just go on back home. And you can tell June I'm back here rested and she can skip this room. I'll clean it up sometime directly. But what you're really going to do is lay back here on this bare mattress and drink liquor and watch television all day. I will if I have a mind to. Why don't he just go on, Jack thought. Well, I'll tell June just to come pick up the wash out of here. She can run a load, the sheets over there, while she's here. Powder's in 'em, Jack thought. Don't nobody touch the sheets. I'll take care of the sheets. Jack started off the mattress and headed for the closet. He didn't know what he'd do with the sheets once he had them, but he didn't want June saying, "His sheets smell funny, Daddy. They smell like lilacs. Look at the powder fogging out of them." Then Burr would really want to know something. Burr sat and watched Jack amazed. "He's clean," he thought. "So he didn't have an accident. What's he doing?" Jack rolled the shoes up in the sheets, grabbed the bundle up, and held it tightly as he crawled back onto the mattress. "Are you out of your mind, Jack? Now I want to know what's going on. I know you're half lit, but this is pure craziness." "He's not getting my sheets," Jack thought. "All that work you need to do to be sure you can find something to do besides bother somebody about his laundry. This is my business. You better go tend to yours." "Perfume. There's perfume on them. What's that smell?" "What smell?" "It's your upper lip," Jack thought. "I was wishing for something. See if I do again." Jack knew he was doing a poor job keeping Burr back. His defiance was not working for him, but against him. He crammed the bundle between his legs and hoped that would be adequate in keeping more lilac scent from wafting toward Burr. June washed all the dishes, swept the floor, and wiped down the cabinets. Before cleaning the next room, she decided to check on Jack, so she dried her hands on Ruby's apron and walked down the hall. "I asked you, what's that odor?" "I might as well be talking to Roland. That's exactly how he'd look at me, holding money he'd taken out of my wallet, hiding it behind his back. I know you took it, now give it to me." And he'd stare me right in the eyes like I was an idiot for thinking so. Jack formed his answer in his head. "You want to know? It's lilac dusting powder. You want to know what else? I put it on these sheets last night thinking she'd like it. I bet you'd have loved to have seen me in here sprinkling like a goddamn fool. And you know why? I honest to God believe she was coming back to me. Now shut up." Then June walked in. "God, that's a pretty thing in Ruby's apron." June knew she'd walked in on the middle of something. She trusted that her father was finding out exactly what. "I love those two," she thought. "Fix this, Daddy. Something's wrong with Jack. Fix it." Burr looked up at June and said, "Baby, Jack's about to tell me why his sheets smell like gardenia blossoms." June looked over at her father, thinking, "Don't take that tone with him, Daddy. You'll never get anywhere with him. Remember how Ruby'd have to handle him sometimes? You know him. Talk to him like you do." Jack was happy to see June, and he wished he weren't in the middle of this tussle with her father, or he'd tell her so. He decided to talk with her when this was over, when he found a way to make Burr back down. But he had to finish this first. "And I was just telling your daddy here he ought to go on and leave me back here. Let you clean the front. Everybody mind his own business." Now I got two sniffing around, Jack thought, and it is not gardenia blossoms. Burr wanted the truth. "June, go ahead and throw those sheets there in the washer, and I'll bet they'd dry outside in no time." And when she started for the bed, Jack jerked the bundle up into his chest. "I told you to leave the goddamn sheets be. It's all I and Ruby's business, but you're bound and determined to know something." "Well, I fixed them for her. Last night I made things ready for her. I thought she was coming home to me. You satisfied? That make you happy?" Neither Burr nor June had heard that voice or seen that face before. Pulling his knees up to his chest, Jack cradled the sheets, pressed his face into them, and began to cry. "I told him to leave me alone. It's all mine and Ruby's business. I told him to go." June sat down beside Jack and rubbed the back of his neck. "It's okay," she thought. We all miss her. It's okay. You can talk to us, Jack, she said. You talk to us if you need to. Daddy didn't mean any harm. He didn't know. Jack spoke half to himself, half to them. Nothing to say. I'll be all right. Started out with nothing, ending up with nothing. Just go on home and leave me be. Made do with nothing when Mama and Daddy died too, he thought. Not like I don't know how. Don't want to, though. I want Ruby. That'd cure me. Why am I in this bed? Never been sick or sorry enough to do this. I got to get up, embarrassing. Ruby'd say when you don't feel like you want to get up and go and do, that's when you got to make yourself. One foot in front of the other. I better sober up first. Why'd I push Jack? Burr thought. Why didn't I just let it go? Satisfying your own goddamn curiosity. Couldn't you tell? This is not my business. Give him credit for having some. Give him credit, for God's sakes, for being a man. Without saying a word, Burr looked at his daughter and asked what he should do. Without saying a word, she answered, I don't know, Daddy. Maybe that's not the right question. Just help him. You've known him all this time. You must know what he needs. Burr looked at Jack, hunched over the sheets, arms around his knees. He needed his mother, he thought, and she died. He needed Ruby. She also died. He needed children and a place of his own. He never had them. I can't raise a dead, but I have shared my child with him, with Ruby. I do have land. I've always thought of this place as his, and hasn't he known that? Whether he has or hasn't, it doesn't matter. It's not his. What else can he have now? Burr moved up on the bed, closer to Jack. I'll do this for him now, he thought. June kept her hand on Jack's head, rubbing his hair, soothing him. She looked at her father and felt that this bad time would soon be over. Jack, I want you to listen to me. June heard her father and rested her hand on Jack's shoulder. What can Burr say? He can't say Ruby's got the coffee on, can't say she wants me to bridle the mule for. What can he say except do the best you can? Burr looked at his daughter's hand on Jack's shoulder and said, I'm giving you this piece of land, Jack. We'll go outside and you can walk off what you want. It's always been yours, you worked it. But now I want you to have it outright. There, it said. Jack lifted his head, looked first at June, then her father, and then out the open window at the field and the woods beyond the field. He wants to give that to you. It could belong to you. You know how you've wanted this place. Don't be proud now. You take it. You take it and work it with the time that's left to you. Ruby'd say to take it, do it, and be glad for it if that's what you want. Otherwise, leave it alone. But you know you want it. I want her more. But do I refuse one because I can't have the other? No, I don't think so. And it won't replace her, I know that. I'll just have something of my own. Keep me from going out of here the way I came in. I will have it. I think I will. And now, Let me try to live.
A Virtuous Woman was written by Kay Gibbons. It was read by Terry Beaver and Kay Gibbons. The recording engineer was Michael Jones. Editing by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Rick Bradley. The associate producer was Sloan Seaman. A Virtuous Woman was produced and directed by Jan Werner. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Ellen Foster, Sights Unseen, and Charms for the Easy Life, written and read by Kay Gibbons.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.